Good evening, and welcome to you all. If you could just take your seats, that would be wonderful. And we'll begin this evening's third lecture by Professor Zygmunt Bauman. Well, let's get to the point quickly. I've been here many times, looking outward. To fill the old theatre once for a lecture is impressive. To fill it three times in a row with no drop-off in attendance is remarkable. It testifies, Zygmunt, that you're not just a much admired academic, but a much loved commentator and figure. So let's start straight away with welcoming you back again. This is then the end of the trilogy of lectures. I began my introduction in the first lecture saying something about Zygmunt's extraordinary career and extraordinary contribution. He didn't want me to do it, but I took liberties once. The second time, I only took them briefly, and today I will respect that we do not once again go over his CV and written contributions, but I would like, for the benefit of those who were not here last time and perhaps have missed even two of the lectures, to briefly provide a context for them. So I will summarize lectures one and two for you in just three or four moments. And if Zygmunt can bear it, I think it might be helpful to provide a context for this lecture. The first lecture was called Demons of an Open Society. Not in the Popperian sense, but in the nightmare of open borders. His first argument was that globalization has created a negative unity of humankind. That is to say, protective barriers and boundaries have been eroded by global economic processes, exposing nation-states and countries to the ravaging of market forces and weakening their capacities to manage those forces. His second point was that we live in a new era of global challenges, from gross global inequalities to global warming and increased political violence. A crisis of political instruments or tools, he then went on to argue, hinders our capacity to meet these global challenges, because power, particularly economic power, is depoliticized through markets, and politics suffers a rupture of actual power. Apocalypse Now then becomes the name not just of a movie, but of the here and now, reality in many places. New Orleans was just one example that he used. Fear today increasingly defines our mode of engaging with the world. We are frightened. Fear replaces political engagement. Social responses become increasingly individualized and solidarity weakened. We focus on things we can influence, like cholesterol levels, hairstyles, clothes, lifestyle issues, and tend to shun those that we can't. Thus, we face a critical question, he concluded his first lecture with, and the question is this: how to bring politics and power back together again to shift from a negative form of globalization to something more positive. In his second lecture, he offered a set of complementary reflections to these arguments, and they focused on the notion of utopia. The notion of utopia marks out a distinctively modern aspiration for another world, a better place, a brighter future, and yet at the same time, the original concept of utopia was also a practical ideal, since it sought to inspire political change to shape and mold our world. Today, this key category, so important to critical thinking, so the second lecture ran, has, like so many cherished things, been deregulated and privatized. Transferred to the realm of life politics, it no longer projects an alternative collective future, but an individual one. Utopia has become the name for individual exit strategies and self-improvement strategies, now offered by computation, computer games, holiday companies, fashions, diets. Hence, the notion of utopia is no longer about propelling us towards something new and different. We live in it. It is here and now. In essence, we make and remake ourselves in the contemporary world, not through books, critical engagement, and reflection, certainly less of those, but more, the argument went, through consumption. And the key image here is a set of processes eased by the credit card. All this, he argued in conclusion, detours us. It robs us of the means to face the dangers and icebergs ahead. We may have won a society of instant gratification, at least for some, but at the expense of security, critical thinking, and social justice. We risk floating in a sea of self-gratification without the science of navigation, the critical projects of utopia, and the wisdom to look ahead. The question, once again, is how to relink power and politics, and yet this Christian risks being lost. So with these sobering thoughts, Sigmund Bauman, we welcome you again to complete your set of lectures here. Many thanks.
My dear friends, all three lectures, Ralph Miliband lectures, with David Held, courageously risked to ask me to deliver, were Ralph Miliband lectures. He was the invisible presence here. I was okay. Problem. I tried my best to perform a sort of ventriloquist act, try to answer questions as I could understand Ralph would answer. They were his questions. The questions were inspired by his life work. And I'm quite sure that he would go on asking them and seeking answers if he was still with us. The first question was, what sort of a world we live in? The second question is, what sort of life? We live in this world? And the third question, to which I dedicate today's speech is what is our possibility? What can we do about the kind of the world which we inhabit and the kind of a life which we live in it? I tried to perform, as I said, ventriloquist art. I'm not sure I succeeded. I'm not sure I succeeded. I managed to make Ralph Miliband's towering presence visible here and audible. I'm afraid I didn't quite succeed. I asked Marion, his lifelong companion, faithful guardian of his legacy, and by character, very, very sharp critic, very insightful critic, and she was not quite convinced that that's exactly what Ralph would say, and I believe her. And that's why today's lecture I deliver with particularly great trepidation, really tremendous trepidation, because it will be even closer than the two first lectures focused on the person of Ralph Miliband. Perhaps not so much on his person as on the historical moment of which he was a part. And then I will try to look at historical moment of which we gathered in this LSE lecture theater are part, and then try to measure the distance between the two of them. And then I will probably find a gap between them. And then I would like your attention for the question whether a bridge can be built over the gap. Ladies and gentlemen, Gilles Deleuze, shortly before his departure 10 years ago, noted, ce sont les organismes qui meurent, pas la vie. Organisms die, but not life. On the other hand, we can find in the posthumously published book by Jacques Derrida, from which I stole the title of this lecture. Chaque fois unique is the title in French. Each time unique is the title of my lecture in English. We can find there a different idea, a different observation, sharing with his readers the three shocks he experienced in the 1990s, having learned in quick succession of departures of three of his very close friends. Jacques Derrida observed that each death is the end of a world. A world that can never again reappear or be resurrected. Death gives its brute, direct, non-metaphorical meaning to all such concepts which we, in phrases which we lightheartedly use, like no way back, point of no return, let us start again, or no starting again, no declaration of null and void of the past, and so on. Each death is a loss of a world, and a loss forever. It is the absence of that world that will be forever. It is that will never end. I think it is an epistemological ground on which we coin the idea of eternity. It is through the shock of death and the gaping absence that follows it that the meaning of eternity, of uniqueness, of individuality are revealed to us, the bereaved mortals. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the words that disappear differ in their importance, and the losses of each must differ in their gravity. In addition, the abyss which is left by each disappearing world is fathomed by the degree to which our own individual worlds have been intertwined with the world now lost and so impoverished presently by its departure. Ralph Miliband's departure was a particularly cruel and painful shock to those among us who rejected the Panglossian belief that everything that could be done to make our shared planet more hospitable to human and humane life has been already done, and who refused to accept that nothing else but more of the same was on the cards. His departure deprived us forever of a world which was Ralph's own, unique and inimitable, but since it was a world of undying hope, it became an indispensable part and a source of perpetual enrichment of our own world. So the contrary to appearances, there is no such a tremendous opposition between Gilles Deleuze and Jacques Derrida's statements. Ralph entered my own world when, in the company of Wright Mills, he visited Warsaw in 1957, shortly after the Polish October, I presume in order to explore at point blank one of those rare happy moments in history when critical thought and emancipatory practice seem to beckon to each other and even occasionally shake their hands. And he never left my world since, and wouldn't be allowed to leave my world if I had my way. True, our worlds did not overlap. They, however, spoke to each other, quarreled more often than spoke in unison, but sincerely sought reconciliation. I think the difference between them consists in the following. Ralph searched for the point from which to start. I could not forget the bitter experience of the finishing line. Ralph knew where he wished to go. I knew where a momentary lapse of vigilance may bring one who is going there. I hope that perhaps we needed each other, but I am quite sure that I needed Ralph more than he needed me. I needed him to keep going. But enough of the role which Ralph played in my personal world, with personal world with its short life expectation, a world bound to go with me to my own grave very shortly. Much more important is what Ralph represented to those us to whom I referred a moment ago, to that we of the hoping, which, unlike the many eyes who compose it, defies mortality. Alerted by Derrida's warning that using the disembodied name of the deceased is always an act of treason, regardless of the use to which it may be put, I will take nevertheless the risk to be accused in such a way, and I would suggest that Ralph's work and legacy stood for the momentous challenge confronted by the intellectuals of his time, and for the ways and means by which they tried to respond to that challenge. The challenge in question was the slow, yet relentless, decomposition, or should we say, evaporation of the historical agent, hoped by all those intellectuals to usher or to be ushered into a land in which the leap towards liberty, equality, and fraternity, adumbrated by the thinkers of enlightenment, but later diverted into the capitalist or the communist coup de sacs, would finally reach its socialist destination. For at least a century, the prime intellectual choice for the role of historical agent of emancipation was a rather mixed congregation composed of the assortment of skills and traits summarily categorized as working class. Forced to sell their creative capacities at a fraudulent price, and victims of the refusal of human dignity which went together with such a sale, working class was expected to unite in a revolution aimed to put an end to the suffering. But since the causes of their misery had systemic roots, that class of sufferers was, according to Karl Marx's unforgettable sentence, the sole class of people that could not emancipate itself without emancipating the whole of human society, and could not end its own misery without putting an end to all human misery. Whether the ascription was or was not warranted was from the start a rather hotly contested issue. It could be argued that, contrary to Marx's belief, the restlessness on the early capitalist floors and outside the early capitalist factory gates was prompted more by the loss of security than by the love of freedom and the need of emancipation. And that once security was regained or rebuilt on another foundation, the unrest would inevitably have boiled away, stopping well short of its allegedly revolutionary destination. It could be argued as well that the recycling of dispossessed craftsmen and farmhands into an apparently homogenic working class was as much power-assisted as it was self-made, and that the economic power could decompose it as much as it was once instrumental in its composition. Well, but all these observations are much better to be made from the retrospective perspective. Looking back, being wise after the fact. At that time, Georgi Lukács explained the evident reluctance of history to follow Marx's original prognosis by another version of Platonian cave, shadows on the cave walls. custom-made concept of false consciousness, that the deceitful totality of capitalism insidiously promotes and won't fail to promote unless counteracted by the efforts of the intellectuals, striving to see through appearances into the inexorable truth of historical laws, and after the pattern of Platonian sages, sharing the discoveries with the deluded cave dwellers. When combined with Antonio Gramsci's concept of organic intellectuals, Lukács' reinterpretation of the vagaries of post-Marx history elevated the historical role and the historical responsibility of intellectuals to new heights. By the same token, that was one of the effects, a Pandora box of reciprocal accusations, imputations of guilt, and suspicions of treachery was thrown open, and the era of the charges of trahison declared, uncivil wars, mutual defamations, witch hunting, and character killings started. If labor movement failed to behave in line with the prognosis, and particularly if it shied away from the revolutionary overturn of the capitalist power, no one but the intellectuals betraying their duty or botching the performance were to blame. Paradoxically, the adoption of such unflattering view of themselves was for the acknowledged, aspiring, or failed intellectuals a temptation difficult to resist, since in an obverse way, a roundabout way, it converted even the most spectacular displays of their theoretical weaknesses and practical impotence into powerful arguments reasserting their key historical role. If not powerful enough to make revolution, at least powerful enough to prevent it. I remember shortly after arrival to Leeds 35 years ago, or a little bit more, I remember a PhD student who, after perusing a few of Sidney and Beatrice Webb's writings, headed to proclaim to an unqualified approval of the tightly packed seminar audience that here he discovered the causes of the non-performance of the socialist revolution in Britain, and the causes of socialist revolution late arrival in Britain were all there. News from abroad, as I remember, only added to the bewilderment and confusion, as the announcement of the imminent farewell to proletariat drifted into England from behind the Channel in a sort of package deal with Althusser's reminders that time has finally matured for revolutionary action. E.P. Thompson's enchanting vision of the British working class immaculate conception met with a frontal assault by New Left Review people, editors, and charged with theoretical poverty, meaning probably the conspicuous absence of intellectuals in Thompson's edifying story. As the theoretically impeccable postulates and prognoses were one by one refuted by events, intellectual circles, with some notable exceptions, among which Ralph Miliband was one of the highest among the towering figures, turned ever more zealously and conspicuously to the self-referential interests and pursuits, as if in obedience to Michel Foucault's announcement of the advent of the specific intellectuals era. Whether the concept of specific or specialized intellectual can be anything else than an oxymoron was, of course, then, as it is now, a moot question. But whether or not the application of the term intellectual is legitimate in the case of university lecturers visiting the public arena solely on the occasion of successive round of salary bargaining, or the artists protesting about successive cuts in the subsidies for theater and film industry, one thing is certain. to that new institutionally confined variety of political stand-taking and power struggle, the figure of historical agent is irrelevant and can be dropped from the agenda with no guilty conscience and, above all, without the bitter aftertaste of a loss. Now here's big question. Must the hopes and the job of emancipation follow the vanishing historical agent? Must they follow the example of Captain Ahab from Moby Dick, sailors who beckoned by their captain to share them in the abyss of history? To answer this question, I intend to enlist, much more potent than my own ideas, assistance of Theodore Adorno and Pierre Bourdieu. Long before the British intellectual's passions for historical agents started to dull, Adorno warned his older friend, Walter Benjamin, against what he called Brechtian motives. The hope that the actual workers would save arts from the loss of their aura, or be saved by the immediacy of combined aesthetic effect of revolutionary art. The actual workers, Adorno insisted, in fact enjoy no advantage over their bourgeois counterpart in this respect. They bear all the marks of mutilation of the typical bourgeois character. And then came the parting shot. I quote, "Beware of making our necessity, that is the necessity of the intellectuals who need the proletarian for the revolution, into a virtue of the proletariat, as we are constantly tempted to do." And yet, ladies and gentlemen, at the same time, and feeling no contradiction, Adorno insisted that although the prospects of human emancipation focus on the idea of a different and better society appear now less encouraging than the prospects which seemed so evident to Marx, neither the charges raised by Marx against the world unforgivably inimical to humanity have lost any of their topicality, nor a competent jury has offered a clinching proof of unreality of the original emancipating ambitions. And so, he said, and he insisted a number of times, there is no sufficient, let alone necessary, reason to take emancipation off the agenda. If anything, the contrary is the case. The noxious persistence of social ills is one more and admittedly powerful reason to try yet harder. Adorno's admonitions are as topical today as they were when first written down. That's my suggestion to you, my friends. And I quote some of those admonitions. "The undiminished presence of suffering, fear, and menace necessitates that the thought that cannot be realized should not be discarded. Now as then, philosophy must come to know without any mitigation why the world, which could be paradise here and now, can become hell itself tomorrow." What Adorno hastened, however, to add was the following. If to Marx the world seemed prepared already in his time to turn into a paradise there and then, and appeared to be ready for an instantaneous U-turn, and if it looked, therefore, that the possibility of changing the world from top to bottom was immediately present, this is no longer, if it ever really was, a case. It is the possibility of a shortcut to a world better fit for human habitation that has been presently lost from view. One could say that between this world here and now and that other emancipated world, hospitable to humanity, user-friendly, there are no visible bridges left. Neither are there crowds eager to stampede the whole length of the bridge in case such a bridge was designed, nor the vehicles waiting to take the willing to the other side and deliver them safely to the destination. Possibilities, one would conclude, are not immediately present. Adorno is quite melancholic about it. He says, the world wants to be deceived. It's a blunt verdict, which sounds as a commentary to the famous short story by Leon Feuchtwanger about the Odysseus sailors transformed by the malevolent witch Kirke into swines and refusing to return to human form, having found the existence of swines much more comfortable and less troublesome. Or a commentary to the Erich Fromm Escape from Freedom, or a commentary on the archetype of them all, Plato's melancholy speculation on the tragic fate of philosophers trying to share with the cavemen the good tidings brought from the sunlit world. Adorno continues, in bitter words, people are not only, as the saying goes, failing for the swindle. They, he says, desire a deception. They sense that their lives would be completely intolerable as soon as they no longer clung to satisfactions which are none at all. So, that has some impact on the criteria by which our emancipation hopes should be judged. Reality, empirical reality, given here and now, because of all that, loses its credentials as a benchmark for the possible. And I quote again, only a thinking that has no mental sanctuary, no illusion of an inner realm, and that acknowledges its lack of function and power can perhaps catch a glimpse of an order of the possible and the non-existent, where human beings and things would be in their rightful place. Well, philosophy, Adorno insists, means the determination to hang on to intellectual and real freedom. And only on that condition it may, as it should, remain immune to the suggestions of the status quo, deprived by people's predilection to deception of its authority. So where does all that leave the intellectuals, the guardians of unfulfilled hopes and promises of the past, the critics of the present, guilty of forgetting them and abandoning them unfulfilled? By a common opinion, inaugurated, it seems, as far as I can judge, by Jürgen Habermas, and contested by a few only of the Adorno scholars, and only relatively recently, Adorno's answer to this and similar question where does it leave intellectuals, is best conveyed by the image of the message in the bottle. Whoever wrote the message and put it in, sealed the bottle and threw it into the sea, had no idea when, if ever, and which, if any, sailor will spot the bottle and fish it out. And had no idea whether the sailor, once he uncorks the bottle and pulls out the piece of paper inside, would be able and willing to read the text, understand the message, accept its content, and put it to the kind of use which the author intended. The entire equation consists of unknown variables only. The message in the bottle allegory implies, however, two presumptions: that there was a message fit to be written down and worthy of the trouble needed to set the bottle afloat, and that once it is found and read, at the time which can't be defined in advance, the message will be still worthy of the founder's effort to unpack it and study. Message in the bottle, expedient, makes sense if and only if someone who resorts to it trusts values to be durable. Who knows, perhaps eternal. Believes truth to be widely applying, applicable. Who knows, perhaps universal. And suspects that the worries that currently trigger the search for truth and the rallying in defense of values will persist. Message in the bottle is a testimony to the transience of frustration and the duration of hope, to the indestructibility of possibilities and the frailty of adversities that bar them from becoming real. In its Adorno rendition, critical theory is such a testimony, and this warrants the metaphor of the message in a bottle. In the postscript to his magnum opus, La Misère du Monde, Bourdieu pointed out that the number of personalities of the political state who can comprehend and articulate the expectations and demands of their electors are fast shrinking. The political space is inward focused and bent on closing upon itself. It needs, Bourdieu insisted on many, many, many occasions, it needs to be thrown open again. And that can be only done through bringing the often inchoate and inarticulate private troubles and cravings into direct relevance to the political process. This is easier said than done. So, as the public discourse is inundated with Emile Durkheim's prénotion, rarely spelled out overtly and even less frequently scrutinized presumptions uncritically deployed. To do its service to human experience, sociology, according to Pierre Bourdieu, needs to begin with clearing the site. Critical assessment of tacit or vociferous prénotion must proceed together with an effort to make visible and audible the aspects of experience that normally stay beyond the individual horizons or beneath the threshold of individual awareness. A moment of reflection, my dear friends, would show, however, that to make aware of the mechanisms that render life painful or even unlivable does not mean yet to neutralize them. To draw the contradictions into light does not mean to resolve them. It's true. A long and tortuous road stretches between the recognition of the roots of trouble and their eradication. And making the first step in no way assures that further steps will be taken, let alone that the road will be followed to the end. And yet, there is no denying the crucial importance of that beginning, of laying bare the complex network of causal links between pain suffered individually and conditions produced collectively. Laying them bare is obviously not the sufficient condition of emancipation, but a necessary one. Indeed, sociologists, to repeat after Pierre Bourdieu, I quote him for the last time, those who have the chance of dedicating their lives to the study of the social world cannot rest neutral and indifferent in front of the struggles of which the future of the world is at stake. End of quotation. And I put it to you, my dear friends, that these words read as a summary of Ralph Miliband's life and the summary of the legacy with which his world enriched ours. Ralph's legacy, as I understand it, is the duty to hope. But what are we to hope for? As it has been stated before, none of the twin accusations raised by Karl Marx almost two centuries ago against the capital, the accusation of wastefulness, the accusation of its moral iniquity, none of them have lost any of its topicality. Only the scope of waste and injustice has changed. Both have acquired by now planetary dimensions. And so did, I suggest to you, the formidable task of emancipation. Adorno's precept. Well, sorry. What I wonder, and that's a big question remaining unresolved, adding the unknown variables to this already extremely complex or difficult to read equation. One may wonder what the readers would make of Adorno's message, where the bottle found its way to the South Seas, to the coast of sub-Saharan Africa or the shores of Asia. Would they understand it? And if they did, would they not take it for another insult or perhaps for a hint that another enemy assault is being plotted? Would they be able and would they have time and patience to set it apart from the messages pumped daily through media satellites up there? Adorno's precept embodied in Ralph's life that the task of critical thought is not the conservation of the past but the redemption of the hopes of the past has lost nothing of its topicality, but it is precisely because of that precept's continuing topicality that critical thought needs continuous rethinking in order to remain up to its task. I believe that, as before, the hope of striking an acceptable balance between freedom and security, the two not immediately compatible yet equally crucial sine qua non conditions of humane society, needs to be placed in the center of the rethinking effort among the hopes of the past that need to be urgently redeemed, those preserved in Kant's, Immanuel Kant's, message in the bottle, his Ideen zu einer allgemeinen Geschichte in weltbürgerliche Absicht, can rightly claim a meta-hope status of a hope that makes all hoping possible. The alternative to paying heed and urgently to Kant's prophetic warning is what Jean-Pierre Dupuy described recently as unavoidable catastrophe, while pointing out that prophesizing the advent of that catastrophe as passionately and as vociferously as we can manage is the sole chance of making the unavoidable avoidable, and perhaps even making the inevitable impossible to happen. We are condemned to perpetual vigilance, he says. A lapse of vigilance is a necessary condition of the catastrophe's inevitability. Proclaiming that inevitability, and so thinking of the continuation of human presence on Earth as of the negation of auto-destruction is, on the other hand, a necessary and hopefully also the sufficient condition of the unavoidable future not happening. Dupuy suggests to adopt, to imitate, to emulate the attitude, the standpoint taken by the ancient prophets. Prophets drew their sense of mission, their passion to follow that mission, as well as their ability to see it through from believing what Dupuy wishes us to believe in the face of the presently threatening catastrophe. They hammered home the imminence of apocalypse, not because they dreamt of academic laurels and wish for that reason their power of prediction to be vindicated, but on the contrary, because they wished the future to prove them wrong, and because they saw no other way to prevent the catastrophe from happening except letting, forcing their prophecies to self-refute. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that unless bridled and tamed, negative globalization strips the free of their security while offering no security except in the form of unfreedom, and such negative globalization makes catastrophe inescapable unless tamed and unless taken under control. Without such prophecy being made and without treating it seriously, humanity can harbor little hope of rendering it avoidable. The other prospect for the coming time, for the starting 21st century, may be that it will become a time in which a new compact between intellectuals and the people, now meaning humanity at large, is negotiated and brought to life. Let us hope, like Ralph Miliband hoped, that the choice between these two futures is still ours.
Well, if you came to the third lecture with any view that you would be simply be cheered up as a result of the analysis of lectures one and two, you are clearly mistaken. But the challenge thrown down, it applies to each and every single person. If you want to go before we start questions, do so now. But we'll take a cluster of questions. I'm sure there are some. It would be hard to imagine how you could absorb that account without also engaging with it. So, whilst people are drifting out, reflect on your questions. If you drift out quickly, please, and quietly, even without talking, would be great. And let's start. Since there's more movement up here than down here, the mics. Questions down here, please. Issues. Hands. Please, yeah. Oh, the mic. We need a mic over on the left. Thank you. Or your right. We'll take four or five comments and then ask Zygmunt Bauman to respond.
The point you made at the end was an optimistic one, but you failed to elaborate on it. How, in a world of democracy, are politicians...
Can you put the mic closer? Thanks.
How, in a world of democracy, are politicians supposed to create this kind of new society from the bottom up, a society based on this intellectual contract, when, in order to get into power, they normally have to satisfy the public's short-term gratification?
Did you hear that, Sigmund?
Yeah.
Yeah?
No.
No, okay. Well, I'll summarize it for you. Isn't democracy essentially myopic, short-term? Aren't politicians caught in time cycles that they themselves can't escape? Doesn't democracy, by virtue of creating accountability once every 4 to 5 years, require of politicians to appease immediate expectations and prevent them from focusing on the intellectual long term or the long term? In other words, isn't contemporary democracy part of the problem of generating greater mechanisms of accountability for these large global forces that you're talking about? Okay? Okay. Okay? Okay, the last one. I did my best. Yes, more. Thank you.
When this, when what was solid melts into air, as you once wrote in an article, a new battlefield emerge. Is there a role for the intellectual, or maybe I should phrase my question differently, under what conditions can the intellectual take the fight or the battle for the utopia into the private world? And by here I mean especially the multinational corporations.
Sigmund, there's a big question. How can you take the task of critical analysis into the private sphere, particularly the private sphere of economic power? Because if you don't reach that, presumably the implication is you will many of things you want to say will fall on deaf ears. Thank you.
I have a question that might be a little general and maybe conventional these days, but I was just curious about what you think of the riots in Paris and other French cities.
You got that one. Riots. This is about riots in French cities. How does your analysis over the last 3 weeks have something to say about what is happening in France now? And if so, what? Yes, please.
Do you see a connection between the declining influence of the state and its identity and you talked about the historical agent eroding?
Do you see a connection between the weakening capacities of states to shape our future and the declining nature of historical agency you spoke about? In other words, is the state yet another declining agency in a world of negative globalization? One more? Please.
Serafim Flore. Dr. Bauman, we all know that democracy is based on the principle of freedom of choice. Can you please tell us what freedom do we have in choosing our emancipated futures? Do we have any freedom, or is it only the hope?
Are we free enough to still make a serious choice about our futures? Or is the only element of analysis you leave us with, in some sense, is in a negative world, that of hope? Okay, well, those are five reflections, and let me just add one of my own. I mean, I just wonder, in these theoretical reflections on globalization, the state of critical thinking, and so on, Sigmund, whether your portrait of the world around us is so negative that it doesn't adequately allow us to see the things that are positive, that are developing, that we need more of, not less of. In a sense, globalization, to take one example, isn't just a negative phenomenon. If you see the poverty reduction going on, for example, in China now, as a result of greater liberalization, open market integration, you can't, it seems to me, just to take that one example, characterize that just as negative globalization, because there are elements of that which are clearly positive for the life chances and self-determination of peoples. So do you not need perhaps a more institutionally differentiated analysis that allows you then to peg in some qualified ways your hopes to particular promising developments as opposed to those which are clearly to be left aside? Okay.
I would dearly like to ask these questions. I would like to ask these questions you asked me, and I would like to listen to your answers, really, because as people who ask the questions, I'm sure, know only too well. They ask them simply because they don't believe that there are good answers to them. And I am afraid I am in a very dreadful position. When you prepare a lecture, you have the luxury, you have the privilege of setting agenda yourself, so you speak only of things which you can speak loudly, something to say you have. But here it comes to the crunch, and I need to answer questions which torment me for a long time now, without any satisfactory, to me anyway, outcome. What you said about the inner logic of democratic government, what you meant probably democratic procedure consisting in election every 4 years and changing governments and so on. It is true that this inner logic of this sort of establishment, this sort of arrangement, is to direct the view of the politician on short-term issues. Politicians are not alone. I think I spoke enough about the liquid modernity in which we live to make it clear that, in my view, the very logic, not only of democratic system, but the very logic of our life in liquid modern conditions has the same effect, namely the long-term commitment, particularly the long-term planning, the long-term design, the delay of gratification, which Max Weber considered to be the major virtuous discovery of modern times. And now all that is in crisis today. So we are all living, as Luc Boltanski, Vasya Pelo, put it very nicely, from one project to another. It is a cité par projet in which we live. The polity, the community, the totality, held together only by short-term projects. So the whole logic of contemporary life points in the same direction, which only means that the pessimist for which I was criticized, and rightly so, by David Held a moment ago, has some ground, really. The problem is, someone mentioned in another question, the weakening capacity of the state, what I called in my previous lecture, I call the divorce between power and politics. On the one hand, power without politics, on the other, politics without power. And the big question which immediately jumps up out of it is, of course, where is the agent who will do it if we knew what needs to be done? That's what I believe, that our major problem today is not so much what is to be done with the world, because on that point we would more or less easily reach some consensual conclusion, but the big problem of which we are really ignorant is the who is able to do it. Where are the agencies? Historical agent disappeared, I told you here, and that caused a major crisis in history of intellectuals, left-wing intellectuals, melioristic intellectuals who didn't want to accept the world as it stood, and so that there is room to improve it and criticize and improve it. Now, it's not the only agent which disappeared. We don't have an agent of collective action which is a match to the globality of our problems. That's the question. Power moved into the global space while politics remained tied to the ground, local, confined by the territorial sovereignty as it used to be before. And that is the major problem. And I think seeing clearly this problem, it doesn't incapacitate, it's not a prophecy of doom. It is a call to arms, it is call to action, it's call to putting the amount of attention which is required to the question of designing and constructing, probably in a long term and through quite a number of blunders, errors, blind alleys, and so on. But constructing such a recreated marriage between power and politics, which would be at the measure of the contemporary globality of our problems. It was once done in history, not that remote history. It was done in the period of the nation building, at the period of the emergence of modern nation states. And at that time, it was also a very, very great leap from the level of local, communal integration to the level, to the abstract, imagined community of society, state, nation, and so on. Another leap of the same kind, only even more covering even larger distance, stands now in front of us. That doesn't, it is not a pessimistic message, it is just the realization how much work will have to be done by the young people who are sitting here until they reach my venerable age. How to transfer utopias into the, how to transplant them, how to insert them into political debate, into the political agora. Well, that's another problem. Very many people try it, very many people do it. We complain when they do it. Fundamental ideas, fundamental values was the phrase used by the person who asked the question. But fundamentalisms are fundamentalisms, among other things, because they ask these sort of fundamental questions and they find quite a few people who are eager to listen, presumably finding that their life is not complete until they do something about these issues which transcend the daily problems, the daily needs, and the daily interests, and the daily pursuits. But how to insert them back into the public discourse is really a huge problem. Aristotle spoke, as you surely know, about tripartite nature of the polity. There is oikos, the sphere of the private, the household, the household farm, house farm, workshop, and so on. There is ecclesia, which is totality, which is the sphere of the public issues, the concerning related to all members of the ecclesia. But in between, there is a very important, I think, in very many respects, probably crucial and decisive intermediate era, area, which is called agora. And agora is a place where the private interests and public issues meet and engage in conversation and practice the difficult art of translation from the language of private interest into public task, language of public task, and public needs into the language of private obligation and duties. Throughout most of the modern era, the greatest minds of philosophers, political scientists, political philosophers, were expecting assault against agora, conquest of agora, subjection of agora from the side of the ecclesia, from the side of the public powers. They will invade, they will conquer, they will stifle the other voice there, they will eliminate the voice of the private dreams and private interests from public discourse. I suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, there's really no suggestion. It is enough to switch on a TV set and look at the next chat show, television chat show, or next soap opera, and so on. That exactly the opposite occurred to expectations. Namely, the Agora has been invaded and conquered by the private interests, but the private issues, private intimate issues, and so on, so on. Under these conditions, I didn't mention it in the last lecture, that aspect, but it's very closely related to what I thought, what I told you last week, and what David Hell summarizing my lecture restated much more powerfully and clearly than I managed. That's one of the aspects of the hard times on which, to use Ralph Miliband's phrase, in contemporary society, utopia has fallen. Has fallen on hard times, and how to return it there, how to open up perspectives of reversing the trend described by Ulrich Beck, trend towards shifting the responsibility for resolution of socially produced problems onto individual biographies. Now, how to reverse the trend? How to seek the more realistic, more humane possibility of resolving the issues arising within biographical construction of individual life with the help of the community, with some sort of collective insurance for individual misfortune and their consequences. That sort of a compact, that sort of collective insurance has been close to be implemented during the glorious 30s, which followed the Second World War. They were the ultimate act, the ultimate stage of the long process of reintegration of human togetherness at the level of nation state. They are proving today, by all signs, they are proving today unworkable, simply because, and all these questions which you ask me are related to each other. So the compact is not workable precisely because of the power falling out of hands of the state. State having a limited sphere of freedom of choice, and not being able to balance the books within the boundaries of one taken separately state. So unless you do something here on a global scale, or you are just losing even as much of that as we have had before. So it's a complex of issues. I repeat again what I told you. I think that's very important. I think I told you at our first meeting what is the difference between optimists and pessimists. An optimist is a person who thinks that this is the best possible world, and a pessimist is one who suspects that the optimist is right. Now, by that reckoning, what I am telling you here, what I'm trying to tell you here, is neither optimistic nor pessimistic. It is hoping. It is hoping that humanity, as so many times in the past, will find honorable discharge also from this kind of trouble.
Well, just a final note from me. Sigmund, thank you so much for addressing the issues today and on the previous occasions. It contrasts for me very much with an experience some years ago when I was asked to debate with the very eminent American political scientist Robert Dahl, who was then 80, he's still going strong, and he gave a lecture. I was supposed to respond. I did. I raised lots of very clever questions, I thought, and he looked at me at the end very quizzically and said, "Those are really good questions, but I'm going scuba diving now, and I leave you to answer them." And he and his wife, he was 80, she was 81, went off scuba diving. A few years later, I sent him a recent book of mine, and I said, this still, you know, is in debate with some of your thoughts. And he sent me back a letter, and he said, I wish I'd answered your questions. It would have saved you a lot of time. So, thank you for not going scuba diving immediately, and thank you now again for a wonderful set of lectures and reflections.